I'm going to talk about yogic alignment tonight. The last time I said that, which was a couple of hours ago, I was asked, what is yogic alignment? Well, alignment is actually a better word. But we haven't got it in the language, so we'll have to just prefix alignment with the K. And now we're going to see what the word means. Alignment, in general usage, means arranging things on a line so that they have some direction. You know, when you have a railway line, we'll have a modern one, monorail, with the Japanese train on it. If we were to put one carriage here, one here, one here, one there, and one there, and link them like this, and then travel at 2,000 miles an hour along the monorail, it would be probable that some of the carriages would not stay in their relative positions. So the concept of alignment is move everything into the same line so that one unified direction can be given to the whole process. There's a lot of mystery about this alignment when it's applied in the field of psychology, but it is absolutely basic in yoga that there shall be alignment between the different parts of the being. Now, if we start with the fact that we have a spinal column, is that a straight line? Somebody told me the other day that I deliberately draw lines, not straight when I'm trying to draw straight lines, so that any good artist in the audience won't be jealous. The spinal column is a method of alignment. And we have three carriages on it. One is the undermost carriage. And we have one at the top. The one at the top is full of sense organs, which we have five special ones. The one at the bottom is just naturally one track, so we'll put a number one on it to symbolize this is already one track. And the one in the middle is two track. We have two lungs in the middle section, and they don't actually work symmetrically. In most people, the right lung is bigger than the left. Also, they don't move in quite the same way, and therefore the alignment at this level is not usually perfect. In the head we have five special sense organs, and they are not usually aligned at all. If you imagine we have a problem of alignment here, we have a spinal cord to make the possibility of that alignment, but we haven't got any natural tendencies to monorail processes other than in the undercarriage. The lowest level has already got unity of purpose. And this is a very strange fact, that that particular aspect of being that has the natural unity that everyone believes they ought to get is the level that has been most condemned by moralists and religious authorities in the past. The only part of man that is naturally one track has been condemned, which implies that there's another kind of one trackness that is possible and that is worth attaining by an alignment process. If we were to consider the simple problem of keeping on the line even three zones like this without differentiation of the middle zone into two and the top one into five, it would already be difficult, because the function at the top is a mentation process, ideation, formal presentation, definition. The bottom one is an urge for energy already preset before birth by certain solar energies, And the middle one tends to oscillate between the two, being battered by orders from above and urges from below. So that if we try to align these three processes, even without subdivision, we have quite a job, because we have to accept the fact that this power below is one track. It is only interested in driving in a particular way, in the manner we call sexual. The top one is concerned only with thinking about it and formulating rules about it, chiefly to control it. And the middle one is a feeling assessment which tends to move towards pleasure and away from pain. So that even at this rudimentary level of thinking, feeling and willing, the problem of alignment of think, feel, will is quite difficult. To do it, you would have to discover some method of bringing into unity of intent the thought process with the primary urge, or persuading the primary urge to subserve some governing concept in the thought process. If you were able to come to terms in this sense, find something that sexual drive is interested in, that you can actually think about, and that thinking will say this can lead to unity, then the conflict between the top level and the bottom would disappear, in which case the middle zone would no longer be battered by orders from above and urged from below in other directions. So the first thing in simple alignment is to try to find out what is that unity principle which will align thinking and basic urging. And basic urging comes from the sun. It is solar energy. You get this solar energy from your food or by direct solar radiation. You know that if a man is very urgeful and you put this man in a place where he can't get any food and you keep him there for a few weeks without food, his urges progressively reduce. And this is a very strange fact, that if you isolate men in this way and deprive them of food, then when they dream, instead of dreaming about girls, they dream about food. A lot of very interesting experiments have been done with this and show quite clearly that if there is a dearth of food and a dearth of women, then the fantasies take the form of food first. And only when the food is supplied and there is sufficient energy put into the body for the food to be able to say, I am sufficiently satisfied, only then does the energy become fantastic about members of the opposite sex. So we see a very interesting thing, that actual individual survival is more important than sexual activity. Obviously, quite logically, because if you didn't exist, then you wouldn't be looking for a member of the opposite sex. Existence comes first. Now let's think, what is the purpose of this basic, already unified drive? It's really a free analytical drive. This drive from the sun has produced, without man's aid, a very large number of different life forms, and these life forms have evolved from very primitive low types of relatively simple function to very, very complex functions. Say the function of a chimpanzee, or of a horse, or a dog, or a cat. These complex functions have arisen without man's aid. And man himself has arisen in the first instance without his own aid. The baby comes into existence not because it has the capacity to give birth to itself, but because it is aided in its attempt to find life by other beings. We haven't got any historical examples of babies precipitating themselves directly from the spiritual world straight into incarnation without the aid of mothers and fathers. We have had one or two cases of them precipitating themselves but without the aid of men. Where women with immaculate conceptions have managed to conjure a spirit into themselves and then delivered a baby. On the two classical occasions that I know of, neither of the women were believed. One was the Virgin Mary, and the other was a girl in Liverpool a few years ago. If we were to disbelieve the one, we should disbelieve both. The important thing here is that there is a purpose in the drive that we call sexual. So we have to find out what it is. And we observe a peculiar thing about it, that it has a one-track mind and it always prefers the best. It always moves towards that efficiency of biological function. If you offer a member of the opposite sex to any given being, and the member that you offer won't work, I don't mean get up in the morning when the alarm goes, if it can't function at all, then it is not an acceptable offering. This means that there's a peculiar inherency in this primary drive that says, I'm actually looking for the best function. Now there's a mystical initiatory statement that the lowest energy in the body is the highest energy in the body, disguised for certain initiatory purposes. And that energy is sexual energy. Sexual energy is looking for the best, but has a peculiar capacity in the time process of making do and mend with the worst until the best comes along. So it shows a peculiar capacity. It is fundamentally idealistic. It always wants something better than it has found, and it has a favorite slogan that's printed along its length: ye needs must love the highest when you see it. Now, from this basic drive unity fact that the sexual energy in people is fundamentally a preferer of superfunction, we can see that we can have a concept in the mind, in the thinking department, that can in fact come into exact agreement with this basic drive. And this super concept, of course, is quite simply superfunction. If you care to think very, very hard for the best thought, to make the best kind of form for the best universe and the best being, you will automatically begin to define this being in terms of superfunction. That is, function carried out to the most superior height that you can conceive. So we have found, in fact, that this primitive does not mean deficient, it means an early form that has been put there. This primitive drive, this unity of purpose, this one-trackedness, has actually got a rationale. And to become thoroughly aware that the sexual energy is naturally choosing, that it prefers the best that it can see within its environment, that it will leave the best in its environment for another better best in another environment if it hears about it. And that this itself, it is quite legitimate to do. Because the law in the universe is not simply a law survive, it is the law improve, the law develop. We've defined love before as the working for the development of the potentialities of being. It is not simply the preservation of being at any given level of existence. It is always the imperative improve, improve function, improve clarity of thought, improve strength of will, improve sensitivity of feeling. Now, to align, to put on this line, we can see the importance of it. Supposing we had a drive from the unity principle below, and we shifted the feeling to one side and the thinking to another side, we would need links to go through like this, and we would be wasting energy, because Our primary drive here, as is the only one that's going to push this being along, if it had to push in one direction for the feeling and then change direction and push in another direction for the thinking and then change direction again to bring the thinking into line with this primary imperative improve, it would actually be wasting energy. You know that if you drive a car down a straight road or shoot a rocket train through a tube, if the tube is straight, you do it in the most economical way. But if you have to drive in a direction other than you want to go, you're increasing the length of your roadway, and you're also generating heat on the turns. If you try to avoid generating heat on the turns, you slow down and lose time. So that it is really tremendously important to recognize that we must pour onto the same line these processes of feeling and thinking. We must subordinate to the imperative of the unifield the thinking process and the feeling process. The one below cannot be subordinated. Its mind was made up before creation. It is affirming a developmental process for superfunction at the end of the road. Therefore, in terms of sheer economy of energy expenditure, the reduction of unnecessary heat, and the saving of time, alignment of these processes is an essential. Now, alignment can only be gained by a human being by actually discovering this concept of superfunction for the head and so clarifying it that it can be seen that the superfunction driven from below by this energy called sexual are exactly the same force disguised and on two planes of being. Now you know that the force that comes from below tends to flood up the body. It actually has chemical methods of switching off intellectual processes in the brain so that men who say, I will only marry a millionairess who is tremendously beautiful and agile and functional, and then they go and settle for the nippy at Lyons. This kind of thing happens. It's caused by certain hormones that are cunningly squirted into the bloodstream and have resonances with an anti-intellectual function. Consider very carefully that if we define superfunction properly, then we will see why this superfunction is a dialectical thing that cannot be faulted with any kind of logic in any time or any world. First, you observe that the unity principle down here drives you as an organism to complete selfishness. It drives you to complete selfishness because every sexual impulse in every individual has only self-fulfillment of superfunction as its basis. And then very peculiarly, dialectically, because it is superfunction it is driving for, it has to come into relation with another being. This very, very selfish, individuated being cannot gain its superfunction unless it comes into relation with another being with the same aim. It is no good a being of superfunction allying to a being without this concept of superfunction, because if so, the one will be profoundly dissatisfied at the response or lack of it from the other. Let's consider this fact. When we think about superfunction at the level of feeling, we will mark in the right lung plus and in the left minus. You will find inside yourself a peculiar fact, a dialectical fact. Your profound selfishness would like superfunction for itself, and therefore it says an unqualified yes to superfunction. But as thought clarifies superfunction, It says that superfunction demands absolutely a total interpenetration reciprocally of beings, not simply one being. Superfunction is a relational thing, and a relational thing is an anti-selfish thing. So it's a very selfish being with a skin round it, a membrane, an encapsulated selfish being, cannot actually present its superfunction potential into actuality except in relation with some other being with the same intent. So that its very selfishness requires it to abandon itself. It must say that it will have as much consideration for the other being pursuing superfunction as it has for itself. It is essentially selfish, and its very, very selfishness and the logic of its selfishness requires it to assert total consideration for the selfishness of the other being. Now, this is the unbreakability of the dialectic, that the absolutely selfish must behave absolutely unselfishly in order to attain its goal of superfunction. Now, we've seen it here in a very simple form. Let's try to consider it actually a moment. This is a sign. You know, there are various initiatory organizations like Brownies, Wolf Cubs, and Scouts, and Freemasons, and Esperantists, and things like that. Apologies to the Esperantists. And in each of these organizations, they have various signs for different levels of being. And once upon a time, the sign for a person that didn't know anything at all about the problem of his own existence used to be three circles like this, not touching each other and with no coordinating lines, just three circles like a pawnbroker's sign, and for the same reason. This was the mark of the common herd folk, whose thinking has nothing to do with its feeling, whose feeling has nothing to do with its willing, whose willing has nothing to do with its thinking. Now, that was a legitimate sign a long, long time ago, because in actual fact, there were three hierarchies of forces, or, if you prefer it, bands of angels. This is quite a considerable time ago. And one of these spheres of being specialized in thinking and thought that everything else was rubbish. And another circle thought that driving furiously about infinite space was the thing, and that thinking was a very feeble kind of inhibitory process, not worth bothering with. And another one thought not at all, and willed not at all, but it just sensitively hung there, feeling aesthetically what was happening through the interaction of the other two. The thinkers were trying to structure the universe. The willers were busy tearing the structures to pieces as fast as they could, and the aesthetically sensitive ones were trembling between, wondering what was going to happen next. So that was the sign in those days. But that is no longer a true existential sign for a person today, because factually today, a human being has got these things in line in some degree. And he also has a peculiar relation between the three, in that the belly level and the chest level, the two lower stories, are linked together very closely. Not many of us have the kind of waist that we have neck. The result is that biologically there is a reciprocal feeding in of the lower urge into the feeling assessment zone, colouring that zone by the purpose of the primary urge. And the head section is removed from it. And if we draw this diagram existentially, we can actually say that it is true that totally untrained persons, and there are millions of these in the world, existentially, who do not have a capacity for interfering with their feeling and volitional processes by their thinking. The thinking goes on, but it has no power over the feeling life or over this primary urge. I was told recently about a program of northern people going to live down south, and they showed this remarkable capacity. They thought everybody down south, up south, was, they were all very, very queer, because for some reason or another, they did not run in and out of each other's house and fry eggs in each other's pans. And their thought process seemed to have no relation to their feeling and will. Their will and feeling ran in and out of each other's houses, and it was terribly friendly. And the thinking process, sitting in a chair in the corner, after letting somebody, of course, love, take the frying pan, said, "Cheeky breeder." This is a thought process quite independent. Did you say that? Yeah? The thought process had no power to interfere with the aesthetic, if such Coronation Street can be called, and the primary drive. And peculiarly, this primary drive showed no interest whatever in what thought had to say about what it was doing. And the aesthetic sense, which thinks that classical music is in a monastery garden, had no interest in either. It's actually possible, if you live in this way, to think high thoughts, like one of these ladies questioned about the world, what is the condition of the world today, and she replied, "There's no country more democratic than England." That was her pronouncement on world politics. When we consider this, we observe this fantastical division, and we wonder, how can this happen? Because we can go to one of those persons and speak some words which go into the intellect, and they have a little short nerve in the brain that goes to the tongue and to certain breathing centres, and it gives you an immediate reply in at the ear, out of the mouth, but it has no effect whatever on the rest of the organism. So this is the mark for today, existentially, of the person whose will and feeling life are intimately related, reciprocally, definitely jitimugge, but the top life has no power to interfere with them. It can pronounce on them, but it can't interfere with them. So that is not a very good state to be. And that badge, you know, you have a badge when you join something, it's always a badge. Well, this particular badge, in terms of sheer economy, we don't make them. Well, we have another badge. And this badge has the three circles with a line down, like that. The line doesn't go out of the circle. And this is called the badge of the aspirant. Because... Are you wearing yours? Or? Badge of the aspirant. This means to say that this person is going to aspire to get from the bottom of this line to the top of this line, and to perceive, initially, just to perceive, the nature of the work to be done. There is an urge. This urge, rising into activity, produces certain responses because laws from above come down the same line and meet in this central zone. So a peculiar thing happens, that an arrow from above marked law is met by an arrow from below marked will, and it produces an Andrew cross in the centre, the cross of conflict. The aspirant, therefore, uses this symbol of the three circles with the line going through but not sticking below and not sticking out at the top. He undertakes to perceive that it is a fact. He doesn't undertake to do any more. All he's doing is perceiving that his thought is one thing, his feeling is another, and his drive is another. He promises not to do anything about it until he gets his next badge. Watching is the first thing. Watch is the key word for this particular one. Just watch. Watch your urge, see where it's trying to go. Watch your thinking and see if it is saying that is quite right, that is where you should go, or whether it is saying it is quite wrong, it is where you should not go. And watch the feeling zone of conflict, where I will meets thou shalt not and produces emotional turbulence. And the least period for very, very energetic people allowed for this stage is 3 months, which means to say is you spend 1 month watching your drive, because you can't do all these things at once initially. So you spend 1 month deliberately focusing on your drive to see where it is going. Then at the end of that month you shift and you start examining your likes and dislikes. And as you have not yet climbed into the head, you can't understand this turbulence, because you observe that your likes and dislikes are changing from moment to moment. You will find that the woman you love, you hate, and the man you hate, you love, and that you're in a continuous state of flux about all the things that are the objects of your desire and aversion. In other words, at this level you would say, you really can't make your mind up at all. It isn't being made up. That is the zone of frenzy. That's an interesting word from which schizophrenia comes. It's a nice Greek word, phren. This word was a word used, phren, for the lady with the long stretching neck at the back. This word used to mean everything that is in the chest, the lungs and the heart and one or two little special centres, including a funny gland that's there that one particle out and then disappears. This level of frenzy is a kind of process, it's a mental process, but it is only concerned not with forms, not with clarity, but with the enumeration of like, dislike, alternations. It is not a true counting process, because there is no K and T in it. It cannot control it, and it cannot crucify it, fixate it. And therefore, it is a continuous alternation of like, dislike, like, dislike. You spend a month in that, by which time you should be thoroughly disgusted with the instability of your being. When you've experienced this instability, this continuous like and dislike of the things you dislike and like, when you discover just how utterly unstable you are as an emotive being, then you go into the head thinking, maybe this will save me, my thinking will save me, and you watch, and to your astonishment you discover, and this is existentially so, not theoretically so, existentially so, you find that your head is full of ideas that are quite chaotic. They are not ordered. There is no alternation of the kind that you have of feeling like, dislike. There is something, in a sense, far worse. There is an absolute pluralization of ideas, and there is no strong central concept to subordinate them and confer unidirectional activity upon them. So you stay a month in your head just looking at your thoughts and observing how these things continuously displace each other. That the ideas, an idea means a form, and that means circumscribed energy, those ideas act as if they were little egocentric beings, each one with its own right, and each one with no consideration whatever for the others. And you will find that some of them are ideas bigger than other ideas, and these bigger ones tend to subsume the smaller ones under them, although the smaller ones don't particularly necessarily like being subsumed. It's rather like a fascist government who subsumes all the people under its definition of the state, whether the individuals within the country like it or not. So you have perceptual memories there, and you have concepts. And some of the concepts are fairly big, and some are quite tiny. But there is no unity principle to coordinate them and force them into activity. So we see again, here, at the end of our third month, that the only unity we've got is the unity of the intent of the lowest level drive to discover a being of superfunction. And it appears to be totally unfaithful because of its essential fidelity to its own intent. As it is pursuing superfunction, it follows that if it finds itself married to a bow-legged lady who can only crawl round the furniture in ungainly manners, then it abandons her and tries another one, K-legged or whatever it can find. Always it is looking for another to the one it's got, because the one it's got in time cannot be superfunction. Superfunction cannot be found naturally in time. It can only be created in time. It can be brought in from other levels and incarnated only by tremendously hard work. And this is the first stage of the hard work. The first stage of alignment, the alignment at the aspirant level, where quite simply there is observation for a cycle of time. And the reason a month is chosen for this is a very good one. A day is too short for you to get through the essentials of the kind of processes going on. A week is not naturally a rhythm that's in nature, but a month is. So if you decided to do this month by month, then the time to start that is to say to yourself that you will phase it on the moon, not on the calendar. You will start on the first day of the new moon, because there are certain relations of fluids in the organism and lunar cycles. So there are appearances of waves and tensions, high tides, according to the moon phases. So it's quite a useful planetary fact of a relation between the moon and the earth and tides in the fluids in the body that enable you to get a greater benefit out of a lunar cycle than you would out of a weekly one, which is arbitrary, and a daily one, which is solar. You do this and study your primary drive, observe its great fidelity to superfunction, so that you can say, that is one thing about me that is quite definitely not going to change, is its opinion about reality. That will give you tremendous security. You climb into the second one, you get exactly the opposite. Total insecurity caused by emotional flux and a continuous variation of orientation and attitude towards the things that you encounter and the other beings to whom you relate. You then climb into the head and discover that your ideas are quite chaotic and really a disgrace to any logically trained person. When you have got through that phase, you then get another badge. Now, in this badge, you're allowed to go out with your line. You start at the bottom and you climb up in that way. And you say to yourself, I am going to undertake to discipline myself because I have actually seen what a rubbishy series of processes are going on inside. You say, I am going to bring them into reciprocal relationship, so that you have to devise a method whereby you can start and go around the being like this. Every time you get an urge, you're going to climb up quickly to examine your emotive response and into the head for the thought process, back into the feeling process for the assessment of the emotive tone and the idea, back into the urge, round again, and you're going to continuously rotate in that manner reciprocally, and again you're going to do it for 3 months. The first month you're going to spend watching your urges and then climbing up through the affective response, your emotive reaction to this urge, and running into the mind quickly to see what ideas have occurred from this fact, and then down again very quickly to the urge, so that your focus in the first month is on this urge process. Remember, you can't do these things except in stages. First month, you always refer immediately to the urge level, climb to the affective reaction, emotive like, dislike, then into the thinking to get the idea correspondent. Second month, you now start with your affective response. You examine your liking and disliking, and you quickly, from the liking and disliking, try to catch the idea that is there with it, because you can't have an affective response without some kind of formal situation in which you have had an experience. So when you get your affective response, you quickly rush up into the head to try and catch the idea to which this affective response is appended, and then you quickly rush it down to try to catch the urge that is stimulated by it and which tends to jump on the bandwagon whenever an idea or a feeling presents itself. So in the second month, you start always focusing every moment here and now with this like-dislike in the affective zone. In the third month, you concentrate entirely in your head for beginnings, and you concentrate looking for ideas. And as soon as an idea appears in your mind, you quickly run it down into the affective zone to see if you like or dislike it, and then you run it down into the urge department to see if you can see precisely what that unity drive has seen in that idea that has made it prefer that idea instead of reject it or ignore it. Because the peculiar thing about this primary urge, it never says no, it only says yes. It can't be bothered to say no. It ignores things that need saying no to, because it's busy saying yes. When we have got through this phase, we can see that we are now at the level called disciple. We are studying this process. We are no longer simply observing, we're actually interfering. And we want to make this interference really important, so we are going to add to it to carry us out of the individuated, finited, closed system. We're climbing up now to another level, which we could say master of this organism. Master masons may stand up and take a bow. In this one, you observe that the essential thing about it is that you are going to attribute every thought, every feeling, and every urge that you get not to the physical body in which you're experiencing. You are going to assume deliberately, it happens to be true, but you'd have to assume it anyway, that the initiating energies and forces that produce the phenomena inside this encapsulated zone in fact originate outside it. That you are battered by forces from beyond your physical body. Forces of the physical world, forces of biomagnetic fields, forces of desire from your ancestors, forces of rationale, ideation, ideology from your educators, and the force of absolute will precipitating the whole process. You actually decide that there is nothing whatever inside you that has not got its origin outside you. Now, we don't need to go any further than this. There are other processes, and I've made an analogy here between the kind of thing you would get in a Freemasonic initiation of the simplest order. There are others, but it would only complicate it to a very high degree, and we haven't time to do it. What we will say is here that we have a stage where you recognize that there is work to be done. That lifts you out. In Masonic terms, it takes you out of the quarry. You know, quarry is a word that you use to symbolize animals who are being pursued by other animals in order to be eaten. When you take a block of marble, a lump of marble, out of a quarry, it is symbolically as if you took a portion of protoplasm, an individual, out of the common mass in order to start work upon it. You have this aspiration. You take it out and you say, now I am a member of the elect. Now observe that the elect are self-elected. It is no good somebody coming along from outside a person and electing that person to work, regardless of the intent of the person to work. There must be a self-election to that work in the individual before any help from outside can actually be effective. So that when Michelangelo goes to a certain place where stone is taken and he selects a particular kind of marble to make a certain figure, he selects one that has already selected itself. It has been precipitated into a certain form. His eye merely recognizes that is a good piece of marble. He cuts it out because it is good, not because he is going to make it good. Because it is good, therefore he cuts it out, and then he carts it off to his studio and starts work. Therefore, the real election is of the individual within himself for the work. If there is no self-election, then there is no evocation from outside to this being to carry it on to the next level. But if that is, we then have the case of the person who aspires to discover the nature of his own being. First stage, he simply observes his three processes. Having observed these for a period of time, he then undertakes to interfere with them. And he is going to divide and cut away. Discipline implies discoupling. It implies getting rid of erroneous responses, and so on. Now, if we want to make this correspond with a slightly more complex yogic reference, but really is not at all any more difficult because it's a matter of simple subdivision of the three we've dealt with, then we do our three circles like this, and we remember that we divided the intellect and the desire level into two to do so. So that we have, this is like the middle finger, we'll write R on there, and we will write I on there and U on there. Now we want O in between here and A here. We've now got five processes. We have a formal principle in the head, and this formal principle originates from an act of primary free will, of initiative. Here we have to think dialectically, because when the initiative operates, it is actually a movement, but the movement itself is caused by an intention in the being. So if we like to think about it in this way, using, say, Christian Trinitarian concepts, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, then we would have to say that the Father is the generative principle itself, the power that pushes, the Son is the form that it produces, and the Holy Ghost is the function of the form, when the will operates on the form it has produced. Now I'm going to simplify this a bit more by drawing one on top of the other, seven circles. Somebody said six. The seventh one I want you to see can only exist in potential until you incarnate it. So in the Revelation it says the number of man and of the beast is the same. Maybe six, six, six. And if you remember that this sixth word is the base from which the word existence comes, then you will know that until you exist, that is, until you become aware of your sixfoldedness, you cannot unify and create the seventh. If we started with our physical body, then this is the physical body down here, and then we put the life force here, and then the desire force, then the mind, and then the will of the individual, we will have above it another will which has made possible this individual. This other one is the progenitors of this individual. But the progenitors, your parents, are still locatable. Or the state, the tribe, the nation is locatable, which gave you the peculiar characteristics you have. But over and above the state, there is another one that we have never seen enter into manifestation, but we know it is there because we have a unity principle and this primary drive function compelling peoples, nations, states, tribes, families, and individuals towards superfunction. So we have to put this top circle on here, not because we can see it, but because we can't see it. We have to think this top one shall represent something that is fundamentally formless but is the cause of all the forms. Now if we count from below, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we count from above, 1, 2, 3, 4, we find that the one that's numbered 4 is the same both up and down. So we can now divide this being into two in this way. And physical body, life force body, desire body, mental body. And because the mental body is in the middle, we have to say that this top part of the mental body shall be called higher mental body, and this part below shall be called lower mental body. And this is a very important division, because you'll observe that you can fold this diagram over. And the one is a reflection of the other. In this mind, which is that in you which evaluates and assimilates, sometimes refuses to assimilate, its experiences. The mind is a mirror of reality. That is not merely a figure of speech. Mirror itself means a substance that by its vibratory processes produces forms and throws those forms back to the energy which produced the mirror. So that when a sense impulse hits you, when an energy input from outside your organism hits you, it produces a vibration. The vibration that is produced in you is MR. Your substance is vibrating. That word MR is the base of memory, or memra. We can see now, if we put a stimulus from below, that is from the earth level, we rattle the physical body by energy input, the physical body itself being permeated by life force, the life force is vibrated, the life force itself being vibrated, the desire field, which belongs to the ancestors, permeating this vital force, also vibrates. And if the external stimulus matches certain functions within the desire field, there is an immediate fire back into physical activity. And when this happens, we call it an animal response. Stimulus from the physical body, life force reverberation, desire reverberation, reflex. We call it an animal response because there is no mentation process in control of it. And it's a simple thing to say, desire response. Now, if we were to consider a lower response, which actually in the human being we very, very seldom get, the level of a knee jerk, we could say stimulus onto the physical body, life force responds. Lower than that is a mineral response, stimulus into the physical body, billiard ball, with cue, mechanical reaction of billiard ball. But we are not bothered with these two lower responses from the evolutionary standpoint. We are concerned with this, that if the stimulus coming in hits the desire level, and ancestors who've charged our protoplasm with desires immediately carry us into activity, we call that a subhuman animal response. Now, if we get into sufficient trouble with that, then will arise a contraction of the field to stop this response occurring, to stop this leakage, and a certain amount of energy will rise up into the mental level to consider the nature of the stimulus, to see whether there is sufficient pleasure in it and a sufficient lack of pain in it to justify a reaction. If there is, we then get the stimulus physical, vital, desire, lower mental, back into the physical action. We can see there's a kind of ceiling here in the mind. And you know you can easily distinguish between your lower mental and your higher mental by the simple test. If, when the response is about to occur, you can inhibit it so that it does not occur, and you can then hold it in suspense whilst you consider to yourself, accepting the cosmic logos, that is pure reason, if you can then decide the worthwhileness of this action, not in terms of physical mechanical reaction, nor in terms of life response, nor in terms of ancestral desire, nor in terms of lower profit, but from cosmic evolutionary imperative, then being able to do that, you are functioning at the level of the higher mind. Here is a ceiling. Now, the whole being contains these seven planes within it. They're mutually interpenetrating, but the lowest ones are unaware of what the higher ones are doing because the lower ones are too dull. And the higher ones are so fine that generally they can't be bothered to look down at the lower ones, which is what led the Greeks to think that the gods just spent their time amusing themselves upstairs in heaven whilst men were fighting and dying on earth. Now, let us call below the level of the mind here, we'll call it the lower triad of the physical body, life force, desire, and above it the higher triad, and we'll call this higher triad the yogic term Atma, Buddhi, Manas. The higher mind here is assimilated to this one. It becomes a buddhic one. It becomes cosmic. It is carried up. So that it is not at all in function like the lower mind of individuated self-profit. It is a mind that only has cosmic evolutionary pursuit of superfunction as its goal. If that higher mind, for the time being, determines what is going to happen, then all the being down below here is gradually brought into line. Now, in order to do this, there must be a very definite and conscious intent to align it. We come to the interesting fact that evolution, up to the point of a person becoming aware of the necessity for this work, has been conducted from outside the human being. The human being has been stimulated by physical stimuli has been invaded by solar energies, has collected experiences, and is invaded by ancestral forces, has made calculations from the stimulus, and fired back into reactivity. Everything has been from below and from without. From below meaning from the mineral end, from the material world, and from without, outside his skin. But at a certain very critical point, it becomes possible to become conscious that there can be, in principle, initiative within. There can be a rescuing of the body from dependence on the external stimulus. When this occurs, there is a reorientation. Instead of allowing this reactivity, the mind itself starts turning upwards. It wants to know what is above here. There is a father, a mother, a son. That is a pre-Christian statement. Father, Son, Holy Ghost. The mother and the son are equated in that pre-Christian analysis because the father posits his own being as his own substance for incarnation. Because it's his substance, it was called the mother. Because in positing it, he posited his willed intent to superfunction as formal activity, therefore it was called the son. So here we have the higher triad, father, mother, son. Here we have an individuated higher mind able to assimilate those and prepared to take orders from them. Now here is where the big work of alignment comes in. Once it is realized that all the forces in the individual human being have their origin outside your skin, they have been involved from other levels, levels of eternal superfunction, then this alignment becomes an imperative. What has to be aligned is the lower triad. We have to say that the physical body must be compelled by God the Father, the will in its pure form, compelled to obey, to bring it in line with the will of the Father. The Father is willing the incarnation of superfunction. Now, the biofield level here, the vital forces, has to be brought into line with the mother-son principle, the middle one of the higher triad. Life force itself must only function logologically. It is only permitted to do those things that actually are superfunctions. It is not allowed to do anything merely reactively to a lower stimulus. So that every life urge that you have has to be permeated with, is this the will of the cosmic logos, the mother-son, and the mother as substance, and son as form logos. No life impulse shall be allowed to function in any other way than that determined by cosmic logos. Then at the third level here, the desire level, the desire of the ancestors shall be completely constrained by this lower circle of the higher triad, the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit is itself superfunction, and that means that the desire self is constrained and deliberately controlled with the concept, is this a superfunction? If it isn't, my desire must be stopped. Now let's define what a superfunction is. You know that if you do something properly, if you shoot a gun or a bow and arrow or an intercontinental ballistic missile or land on the moon and collect your rocks without forgetting them and so on, whatever you do perfectly so that there's an entire matching of your will and the form that you will and the function of the form that you will, that is a superfunction. Let's look once more. We've got a line through the mind. I want to say, consider this line to be the surface of the ocean. Everything below it is water. We could say that water is the water that John the Baptist used to baptize you. So if we say this is water down here, we'll have to say this is fire up here to complete our dialectic. Water and fire are symbols. Water of plastic substance, fire of initiating energy. And we have to say that the water would be totally static, tank, wartime type, undrinkable water, if it were not actually permeated with the fire of the upper triad. And man is somehow a kind of fish. There is a fish, which may still be found off the coast of Australia, which has an eye in the top of its head, as well as two other eyes. Now imagine that this fish has got one eye there, and two eyes down below. Now Donald, this fish is a man, and he's swimming with two eyes in the water and one eye out of the water. His one eye out of the water, of course, he's looking for birds. The two eyes below the water are looking for birds, but they're seabirds, cormorants and things like that. Anything with a very powerful, substantial appetite. Having two eyes in the water means convergence, which is a very important thing. If your eyes did not converge, you would not become individuated. Imagine you've got two eyes for a very definite purpose. It is in order to allow consciousness to fixate itself on a finite object. Whereas this other eye outside the water, you must consider it as a kind of spherical eye, its job is not convergence but total awareness. Now actually this kind of thing exists in your own eye, because peripherally you are aware of the gestalt dynamically. The periphery of your eye is very aware of movement but not of form. Whereas that focal center of your eye, which is aware of form, is not aware of movement. So when you converge with your two eyes onto a finite object, the convergence fixates you at the individuated finite level. And this commits you to a linear temporal experience that will force you to analyze the world and to experience that analyzed world in a separative manner. And thus you would be able to experience, in color terms, red as red, blue as blue, yellow as yellow. But you would not be able to see the effect of red on green, orange on blue, purple on yellow. You would see red, then you would see blue. And if you wish to compare them, you would have to do what you call remembering red in order to compare it with blue. So that in the temporal, separative, serial process, the convergence, which is symbolized and objectified in the eyes, is the means whereby you are nailed into the time process. And in that nailing in the time process is a guarantee that until you have experienced in separativity all the different aspects of your being's functional possibility, you are not allowed to focus on your unific simultaneity consciousness, I. The essence of this is that in the time process, by convergence, by finiting, you become thoroughly aware of what deprivation means. If an artist were to be given red to paint with, out of a pot, and say, paint your picture with this, and would you like another color? Yes, I would like blue. Right, here is blue. But don't look at the red. We'll cover the red up now so that you can't see it. When he looked at his picture at the end, he would find it would be a horrible mess. What actually happens when an artist paints a picture, he modifies his reds and his blues and his greens and so on by looking at all the other colors. And in this modification, he produces a unity. That's because he's already equipped with this super eye, with some degree of raised lidness about it. But to comprehend the real value of simultaneity and comprehension, there must be a temporal, separative, linear experience of deprivation. You cannot truly evaluate superfunction unless you first go through a series of steps of deficient function to gain the necessary energy to prefer superfunction to deprived function. So now we will say, let us represent here fire equals the higher triad, and is God the Father, Mother and Son, or the Father, Son and Holy Ghost. And below we have a physical body with life impulses, reproductive, ancestral desires. And between the two we have a mind that looks down and a mind that looks up, resting on the line with two eyes below, convergent, individuating, separative, and one eye above, affirming unity. When we remember the function of the upper triad, pure will, immediate response, positing its own form, so there is no quarrel whatever between the will and the idea, and then the same will entering with its power into the form to make a function that exactly matches the form that has been willed. When we think of that triad as superfunction, and we think of the behavior of the lower triad, that every chance physical stimulus that comes to it, every outburst of soul energy, every ancestral invasion scatters the unity of purpose in it, then the problem of alignment is how to make this lower triad obey this upper triad. And to become aware of it is the first step, that there is a necessity for this alignment. When this necessity is thoroughly understood, because only in this necessity's embodiment can function be improved and ultimately become superfunction, then there can be a definite verbal statement of intention to do the work. So intention to do the work is very, very important. Buddha would have said, right at the beginning, right intention. Your intention must be the true intention to produce superfunction, to define superfunction, and then with right intention you enter into the next phase, and that is the use of the creative imagination to visualize, to make a picture of this right intent. This is very, very important. If there is no visual imagination of what it means to have a will that projects an idea and agrees totally with the idea it projects, and then animates, vitalizes, dynamizes that idea into a function exactly correspondent with it, if these do not occur, then nothing can happen down here of any efficiency. Here at this higher triad level is the great secret. Visualize, make a mental image. You know that some people are not visual types, they're audio types. They hear words when they are thinking. Those who can visualize are lucky in the sense that ancestral experience has so conditioned their protoplasm that they produce images fairly easily. The others, who are audio types, will have to work to make that visual thing, and they will have to define verbally the kind of picture. So that you have to go, if you're a verbal type, you will have to go to a phase in which you deliberately describe pictures verbally that you cannot actually see mentally. And then you energize your verbal definition of the picture that you would see if you could see it. That's the second phase. And when you have this picture, you draw lines straight through all these verbally defined things, and you are going to use this diagram as a yantra. And we now collapse the thing down and we say, we'll go back and keep it simple because this will help us. We are actually concerned with the alignment of a primary drive, a feeling assessment, yes, no, and five sense data, all to be brought into alignment. And we're going to make this by subdivision into seven. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We're going to put the larynx in there. It's very important. The larynx is that little box where the Jenny Wren lives. And the human voice talking to itself, formulating its definitions, is wired up with certain brain centers. Those brain centers are wired up with the lower sexual center, so that if you get the correct verbal formula with your mind in your larynx, you begin to establish a bridge. Remember the Pope's title? Pontifex, the bridge maker. The bridge is in the larynx. It is only by verbal formulation of your intention to make that being into an exact reflex of the Father, Will, the Son, pure form, the Holy Ghost, pure function. Only by defining these can you actually persuade the lower triad of your being to echo, to resonate with them, and ultimately to incarnate them. Therefore, it's in this larynx, in this voice box, where there is a sudden change. Like we said before about the people who have no coordinator, whose head functions independently of their feeling assessment and primary drive. If they were to make a vocabulary and make themselves formulate in their minds what they were doing, and keep inserting verbal descriptions of their feeling responses and their basic urge directions, then they would change. But if they don't verbalize, they will never change. Now, the function about the verbalizing, when you verbalize, you serialize. And serialization takes time, and it stops the simultaneity you need. And therefore, the diagram, the yantra, is made to save time and to give you a simultaneous diagram instead of a serial number of words. So you define verbally exactly what you mean by something, and then you make yourself a visual diagram of that thing which you mean. Now here we have a diagram, and this diagram means that there are three parts and that only the larynx can unify them. The larynx has got to work. There are certain forces in there that are tremendously important. And as far as humanity is concerned at this stage of evolution, if he does not become aware that verbalization is his savior for the time being, he will not do it. So now we have to define, using this voice, that this head shall only be a head like God the Father. Notice the inversion now. We've had a prime drive towards superfunction down here, sexual, and we've got this one up here, thinking but powerless, and we've got this one in the middle. The middle one always stays the middle. Father, Son, Holy Ghost. In terms of primary drive, the Father would be in the sexual department. But by this verbalization, you posit that drive in your head. There's a complete inversion. The yoga term there is OJAS. OJAS, you'll observe, is an anagram of Jesus. You can change U to O, A to E, and then just alter the order of these. This is an anagram of Jesus, and this means affirmation saves. It is sexual energy by verbalization referred back to its origin, God the Father. There is no sexual energy in the whole universe other than the absolute will of God the Father. In the same way, there is no logic in the mind of man that is not God the Son. In the same way, there is no function in the organism of man that is not the Holy Ghost. So that one can become aware of this diagram in a very special way and say that instead of piling up seven separate circles and drawing a line through for analytical reasons, having done that analytical work, we can condense the seven back onto the three existential ones, and using the larynx as a central reference, central in that the two lower ones are reciprocal and must be treated as one, and the top one is one, so the larynx is between two. We take, by means of verbalization, facts of being. We center ourselves in the body. We feel that we have a spinal cord. We understand that the meaning of the spinal cord is alignment. We turn from an amoeba to a paramecium. Paramecium himself is the first alignment in the biological world. He is out to pursue superfunction and unidirectionality towards it. Then when we think inside our head, we say, I will tolerate nothing in my head other than God the Father, the will that posits superfunction. So I will only allow myself to think, is this thought a thought that will produce superfunction? If it won't, out. I don't care what great volume it came out of, or what great public house politician it came out of. Wherever it came from, it is out if it does not fulfill this condition. Purity of heart is to will one thing. If you can't say this act is worth willing for its own sake and not as a means to another one, then it is not the will of the Father. Those acts that are the will of the Father are acts that you could do if they were totally isolated and led to nothing. So here we see, in the head where the thinking is, we find the sexual energy has risen up into the head and has become the will of God the Father. We come now to the middle zone, which we said was the mother's son, and we see now that we have a new kind of logic. The logic of the relation fire-water, in which the keynote is compassion. That in the heart of man, instead of I love this, not that, there shall be placed a universal statement, I affirm co-suffering with all living beings. Whatever feeling of like or dislike that appears, that does not find itself unable to be subsumed under the heading universal compassion, is out. Then we come down to the bottom level and we affirm that whatever activities of any kind of the physical body that may arise under impulse, which is usually sexual, whatever they are, unless they will incarnate in the being itself, and if there is to be a child involved, in the child that is to be projected, then that physical act is out. So you're not allowed a thought that is not exactly the kind of thought that you would will if you were omniscient. You are not allowed a feeling except one that is aligned with universal compassion, and you are not allowed an external physical act unless that act will subserve the appearance in yourself or in other beings of superfunction. And with this threefold test verbalized, you can say that you are in the process of alignment. It's quite obvious that this alignment process needs a lot of work. The best way to do that work is to give yourself definite periods. Monthly periods are the shortest effective ones that you can do. And then after a certain length of time, you reassess yourself and do each exercise again from your re-evaluation level. The whole object of this alignment is to make it possible for you to say that when I will something, I will like the absolute will of the eternal creator. That is, never mediately. Never to will one thing for another thing, but only to will that thing for itself, because repeated eternally, it would still be worth willing. And at the sun level, to have compassion for every living being, to verbalize the necessity for this compassion, to center in the heart to do this. The heart actually is not just simply a physical structure. It is shot through and through with energies linked by resonance with all other hearts in the universe. So that when you center in that heart, with this true, clearly verbalized necessity for universal compassion, the moment you gain that compassion, then all hearts in the universe, quote a lady from Carmen Jones singing a song, all those hearts will factually resonate, and there is a mutual empowering of hearts at the point of that being. If another being doesn't do it, his heart is not empowered. But the being who does it, his heart is empowered by the cosmic heart. And in the same way, when a physical act is being done, if that act can be affirmed for itself as a pure act, a superfunction, with coincident will, pure logic, and resultant activity, if that act can be so affirmed, then there will be an immediate connivance and supporting of every actualizing force in the universe. That means to say that when an individual being manages to clarify in his mind by means of his larynx, by means of verbalization, what he has to do, and with the aid of this diagram, he restates it. This we call inbuilding the yantra into the body. If you put this into your organism, so that every time you feel yourself, you see circle, 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 straight line right through, little verbalizer, and you feel this inside your body will begin to resonate to the yantra. And you say that the energy so formulated in the body will bring the body into this state. The result will be that the higher triad, the God, Father, Son, Ghost, will invest itself in the body so that there can be no doubt whatever to that being that he or she is a true and valid incarnation of that Holy Trinity. When that happens, there can be no question of being argued out of it from outside your skin. Until it happens, you will be argued out of your skin by some forces outside you, under the direction of that same Holy Trinity that is trying to invest itself in you. Now here we have the yantra, the diagram, put it mentally on you, and then state what it means. Every yantra has a word of power. Now to say this, if we say E, A, U, that when we say E, A, U in this manner, we are using a word of power. If we say U, A, E like this, this is a word of power. We must be able to say this word of power both ways. And when we salute the origin, we must make mentally a gesture. So we have the yantra, the diagram, and we have a mudra, a gesture, an actual process If I start with U, because this is a historical fact, I'm urgeful, then I aspire, then I ideate. If I say U-R-E in this manner, and I know what I'm saying, then if I say Y, this is a mantra in sound, a mudra in the gesture, and a yantra, the diagram, inbuilt into the body. And this gesture must be made so that it finishes up outside your skin, so that when you say U, A, E, you must carry those three above your head. If you do this simple ritual, when you get up in the morning and when you go to bed at night, you will inbuild this energy structure, this higher triad, into the lower triad. And the mere act of making the gesture with complete consciousness of what it means aligns all the energies in the body and begins to bring them into conformity. Finally, I will say this. The church, for the last 6,000 years, has known this to be the goal of humanity. It has not been allowed to tell the real meaning of its symbols and its doctrine because of the unassimilability of the doctrine to the people whose heads are not connected to their body. You can find a historical document that says, oh, those people's heads are in their chests. That means that they had no ideation process above the level of their emotive response. Now, because of this retention of the secret, there has appeared in the world chaos. And this chaos in the world is a precondition to the appearance in millions of individuals for a statement about the truth. So that historically, now, it is possible for millions of people to understand and assimilate the doctrine that the churches have been compelled to keep to the top hierarchy of the church. So that now, we don't have to be rude against priestcraft in the past because it was a necessity because of the headless people. But today, as a direct result of tremendous misrepresentations, men have been thrown onto their own centers, like men are when they're cheated. And in being thrown on their own centers, they have become internally so chaotic and so aware of the necessity for a solution in the world that it becomes possible to tell millions of people the real meaning of that Holy Trinity. And it becomes possible, when it is heard, to take seriously that when Christ said, I come that you might have life and have it more abundantly, that he was rather dragging out, I've come to give you superfunction. Or superfunction is the message. He came and said, love one another. That was a special thing to throw you into terrible stress-strain relationships. That has now been changed to love is the development of the potentialities of being. And this mode, which has been kept secret in the top ranks of the hierarchies of all religions, is now to be expressed in a variety of ways and will appear more and more in novels and plays on TV and elsewhere. And you can see a lot of it is leaking out, even in terms of science fiction. The necessity for superfunction. The threat of computerization is the final threat to make men thoroughly aware of what individuation and free self-determination means.